Hare Krishna. And welcome. During one of the rare Irish heat waves that we have, it's warm July. So today I'm going to talk about attracting the goddess, the divine feminine. Most religions, I think most of them, Christianity, Protestantism, Islam, Judaism, there's no goddess. They don't recognize her. They don't see her. Yet in Hinduism, in Vedanta, which is our tradition, to some limited extent in Buddhism, the divine feminine is extremely important. Catholicism, they recognize the divine feminine to a limited extent in the form of Virgin Mary, mother of Jesus. But in Vedanta, she figures prominently. So, what does it mean to attract the goddess, the divine feminine? Why is it important? Why is it significant? What would happen? Well, the goddess will bring happiness, joy, success, fulfillment of life purpose, development of talent and expertise, wealth, love, material love, spiritual love, love of God, and that all important one, peace in the home. Peace in the home, my friends. It's just nothing like it. If you're married, if you live with a partner, peace in the home is key. So we see many aspects of the goddess, such as Lakshmi. Well, Lakshmi is the main one that you think about. But they all use, they're depicted using a mudra, or a couple of mudras. And that's the one you always see. That is the Abhaya mudra. Abhaya means?
Fearless.
Fearless. Don't worry. I'll take care of it. I'll protect you. And the other one is this one. What is this one? Varada mudra. What does Varada mean?
Benediction.
Delivering your desires. Fulfilling desires. With Lakshmi, it's usually coins coming out of her hand. But it's not just coins. So I want to look at this. I'm not trying to so much establish worship of the goddess as much as I am trying to help you to understand the importance of the divine feminine and how that filters down into our world and our relationships between male and female, etc. So I'm going to take an archetypal approach to Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. How do you approach the world? So we'll use Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva as our archetypes to give us some insight into that concept. How do you approach the world? So Brahma, who's affiliated with which mode of nature? Rajas. These are guna avatars. The gunas are the modes of nature. So we're speaking more within the confines of material creation. Brahma being the creator, his mode is rajas, mode of passion, or the mode of desire. His approach to the world is control. He tries to get everybody to do what he wants them to do. and put them in their place and create all the various aspects of the world. So rajas, if you're in the mode of rajas, of passion, then you have desires, material desires, that you are trying to get fulfilled. So how do you go about that? You try to move the pieces around the chessboard and get them to do what you want them to do. Vishnu is in the mode of sattva, the mode of goodness. Does he take a control approach? No, he doesn't. Vishnu tries to assist the world, not control it. He tries to help and make things happen. Shiva, the destroyer, among other things, is representative of which mode?
Tamas.
Now, tamas is the mode of darkness or the mode of ignorance. We're not really looking at Shiva in this sense, in this context. How does Shiva approach the world? What is his vision, his vantage point? Renunciation. He doesn't really care that much. Can't really be bothered. That's Shiva. So that is also a symptom of tamas, but not so much the ignorance part, of course. But more like, yeah, I don't really want to get involved. That's Shiva. Shiva is a great yogi, and he spends his time doing what? Meditating, right? So, rajas, sattva, and tamas. Brahma has certain preconceived notions of how things are going to go. So that's why he wants control. He had Daksha. Well, everybody's his children. Daksha was one of the Prajapatis, and Daksha undertook a great yajna. And back in the day when they do these huge fire sacrifices and a lot of material was used and they got tons of ghee and all kinds of different things to offer into the fire, and they would give the Brahmins so many offerings and gifts, etc. That was more the Vedic period in which there was an exchange. So we'll do a fire sacrifice because we want what? We want wealth. Or you want to get pregnant, or you want to find a spouse, or we want power and position, and we'll do an elaborate sacrifice. That's what they would do in the Vedic period. So Daksha was doing that as well, and he was the son of Brahma, who was just like Brahma in terms of his trying to control things and manifest things. That's fine on the one hand. Then Brahma had some other sons, four Kumaras, right? And he wanted them to go forth and multiply as well and have children. How did that work out? It didn't. They weren't interested in that. And all they were interested in was God realization and developing their own consciousness. And they remained young. I mean, very young. That's how they remained. So they didn't take Brahma's approach. That's the point. Vishnu, Brahma desires, Vishnu tolerates, Shiva detaches. If we, in our lives, are controlling or overly controlling, what is the emotion under that? Underlying that?
Fear.
Fear of what?
You don't know.
Fear that what we want to happen is not going to happen unless I do this, this, and that, and you know, I need it to happen. So from that point of view, Brahma could also operate in fear in the sense of trying to get things done. Vishnu, he assists and is helpful, but he's fearless. And he's more likely to accept things as they are, bring you along, If you want to come along, fine. If you don't want to come along, that's fine. That's up to you. Of course, as we know, here we worship Vishnu in his form as Krishna. Krishna is similar. Krishna is not trying to force you to do anything you don't want to do. Krishna is the all-attractive person. He's trying to draw you in with his attractive features into a loving, reciprocal relationship. And then Shiva, well, there's no fear. Again, it's detachment. That's Shiva. When it comes to the goddess and manifestations of the goddess, Brahma tries to have dominion over the goddess. He wants the goddess to do what he wants her to do, whatever aspect it is. Excuse me, Saraswati would be the best example. Vishnu, how does he interact with the goddess? He respects her autonomy. He respects her autonomy, her independence, her decision. This is a very important point. The more, when you go into relationship, one of the essential elements in relationship is, or the essential element, is mutual respect. Absolutely essential. If one party does not respect the other party, they will treat them how? Disrespectfully. And also, they won't offer them respect in the exchanges that take place between the man and the woman. So, respect is extremely important. I don't know how you can have a successful relationship without respect. And if respect is lost in a relationship, good luck in trying to renew it, to win it back. Shiva, what's Shiva's idea about the goddess? He's kind of disinterested. At least initially is what we find out from the Puranas. He just wants to meditate and carry on, live in the high Himalaya and in Kailas, and that's good for me. I don't really want to get involved. Shiva doesn't want to go into society and establish himself in society. He doesn't think like that. Okay. Humans believe that the entire creation and its contents, what? Belongs to them. Isn't that what humans think? There's all kinds of evidence of that. So, we accumulate property. We try for material status. It's similar to Brahma, Rajas. Remember the story about Brahma showing up in Vishnu? And, you know, Vishnu said, well, which Brahma is here to see me? And he, what do you mean, which Brahma? So there's a little bit of ego involved in his status and his station. So this is how human value is measured and validated in the material world. By what? By stuff. By what you have, what you own, what your status is, who knows you, what your influence is. This is Rajas. Since we don't know who we are and what the purpose of our life really is, if we don't know who we are, and we're not trying to follow our life purpose, then what do? In its stead, we accumulate material things. We shop. We buy property. We want people to know who we are. We want to be recognized. Is there something wrong in all of that? No, it is the material world. But if that's your sum and substance, if that's the be-all and the end-all, then maybe. Brahma's need for control explains why Brahma is what? When you compare Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, Brahma is not worshipped. How many Brahma temples you been to? I've been to one. Pushkar? Same one. In Pushkar, in Rajasthan, there's a Brahma temple. That's the only one. Why? Because Brahma's approach is not the best approach. It's more rajas or materialistic. Okay? That's why he's not worshipped. Vishnu, the mode of goodness, is identified with those who have discovered their higher purpose in life or who are on the path to discovering their higher purpose. That's why we're devotees here of Vishnu. Vishnu, Krishna, same. Vishnu, forearm form. Krishna, two-arm form. Same. So, people who have discovered the higher purpose of life in terms of spiritual identification and acts of compassion and kindness toward others. That's Vishnu. Shiva, the renunciate yogi, is simply, again, disinterested, detached, can't be bothered. It's not like Shiva's a bad guy. He just doesn't want to participate in all of this. So, we have devas, the gods, and we have devis. The devas create, preserve, destroy, and whatever other verbs you want to mention. And the devis, the goddesses, the divine feminine, does what? They provide things like knowledge, like wealth, like power, like position. So they're the nouns, and the gods are the verbs. Do we need them both? Yeah. Absolutely. So let's just run down a few here of the goddesses and see how this might work. So let's start with Bhumi. Who is Bhumi? Earth goddess. Most of us in the material world, many of us, try to own and control nature. We know this. We have all kinds of problems in our world because we try to own, control, manipulate, and exploit nature. That's what we try to do. And how does that work for us? Is there any backlash? Is there any reaction? Is there any negative reaction to all the things that we've been doing all these years? Yes, countless negative reactions. Because we go about it in a very unconscious manner. We do not show Mother Earth regard or respect. Nor do we offer her protection, stewardship, or husbandry. If you love a woman, do you not protect her? Is that not a symptom of your love? Do you not look after her? Do you not see to her needs? Now, as I go through this, for the ladies, it is about embodying the goddess, embodying the divine feminine. It's more from that point of view. So I didn't mention that. So, King Vena was on the planet many thousands of years ago, and he was one of these kings who was exploiting and manipulating the resources of Mother Earth. So, she more or less shut things down. And it's stated in the Vedas that if you exploit her for too long, she'll create problems. You will get drought, you will get pestilence, you will get famine, you will get storms and diseases and epidemics and all kinds of stuff. So Vena was kind of on this trajectory. So the Brahmins had to get rid of Vena, and Prithu then appeared, and Prithu was the next king, sort of a descendant from Vena's line. And Prithu was actually a partial incarnation of Vishnu. And Prithu had to initially chase the earth around to catch her because she didn't want to participate anymore. And so he had to convince her look, I will take care of you. I am now the king. I will see to your needs. You will be treated well. You will be treated respectfully. So I need you to come back and provide what you provide for everybody. So he had to, it took some time and energy to convince her, but it happened. Now, the next one we want to look at is, I'd like to juxtapose Durga. Durga is Mahamaya. So she is the external energy personified of the material nature, correct? And you know about Durga, we've talked about Durga. And if you're from India, you definitely know about Durga. And then, when Durga becomes very upset, very angry, because normally she's very nice and very well behaved. But when she gets angry, what happens? Out from the middle of her forehead comes Kali Ma, Kali Devi. And you don't want that to happen. So now we're having a look at, if we treat the goddess like we would treat Durga, we would get the Durga effect. If we treat the goddess or women, if we don't treat them well, then we will get the Kali effect. Do you want the Kali effect? No, you don't. And do the women want to step into the Kali personality? No, they don't. So what's the juxtaposition between the two? Durga represents culture. When everything was created, there wasn't initially culture. Culture had to be established. And culture in Sanskrit is Sanskriti. That is culture. Kali is just unbridled, uncontrolled nature, like an overgrown jungle, if you will. And that we call Prakriti, nature. But nature does have to be formed and shaped and modified if we're going to have culture, if we're going to have civilization, right? In the forest, in the jungle, it's the survival of the fittest, survival of the strongest. There's no protection. If you're the strongest, you'll end up on top. You'll sustain. In civilization, it's different. There are rules, there are regulations, there are protections in place, there are laws to protect the strong, the weak, everybody. In the jungle, it's survival of the fittest. In civilization, it's survival for all of us. And we can all walk down the street. We don't have to be the tiger or the lion. Durga has constructive power. Kali has destructive power. Durga offers protection. Kali offers punishment. Durga, if you see pictures of Durga, she's very, very beautiful. And she's dressed beautifully and she's ornamented. So with precious jewels, lovely garland, etc. And Kali is naked and her hair is disheveled out in every direction. Durga is Brahma's daughter because he created her. Vishnu's sister. Yogamaya is also an offshoot of Mahamaya. So Vishnu's sister, when the seventh child of Devaki was born, all right, and it was a girl. It wasn't supposed to be a girl, and Kamsa could not kill this child. She leapt into the air and said, "I'm Yogamaya. You're in for it now, my friend." Remember? So that's Vishnu's sister. Krishna's sister, effectively, right? And she's Shiva's wife. And Kali, what does she do with her husband? She dances on his corpse. So we don't want that girl in our lives. the Kali One. Domestication cannot be through force with Durga. You can domesticate Durga, but only through expansion of consciousness and love. There's no domestication possible with Kali. It's not going to happen. So, when you see pictures of Kali, what does she have? She has a garland of what?
Skulls.
Are they male or female? Oh, they are male, let me tell you. And she's holding in this hand one freshly lopped off head. And that's whose head? A man's head. And then she has a chopper. What is this symbolic of?
Detachment.
It's detachment, all right. Chop it off, that's detachment. This is symbolic of the male ego run amok. Does she just haphazardly go around and chop men's heads off? No. She doesn't. This is only when the goddess is disrespected. Now, you know, how does this apply to us? We don't want to bring out the worst in the goddess or in the feminine, the divine feminine, what to speak of the human feminine. We don't want to provoke those kinds of reactions. And the male ego, as I've mentioned many times, is often overarching, overpowering, and sometimes it deserves to be chopped off. Not the head, the ego. Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about Parvati. So there's Shiva. He's busy meditating, and there's a big to-do between the gods and the Suras and the Asuras. They're all this perpetually at war. The perpetual war between good and evil. We know it well. We've heard about it since we were children. And Shiva's meditating. And that's really all he wants to do. But the gods, they go to Brahma. We need help. Brahma says, no, go see Vishnu. Get him to help you. So they go see Vishnu. No, I'm busy right now. Go see Shiva. We need a champion. To fight, none of us are strong enough to fight the Asuras, to fight the materialists at this stage. Can you help us? Will you produce a child? That was their. So they discussed this and they thought, you know, Shiva's not going to go for this. We can't just say that to him. So what should we do? Oh, here's a good idea. We'll send Kamadev, Cupid. We'll send him. Shoot a few flower arrows, get his erotic side going, make him want to engage in a little bit of sexual activity, and that way we'll get a champion out of it because it'll be a son of Shiva. So that's what they do. They send Kamadev. What happens? Shiva's, of course, absorbed in meditation, and all of a sudden he goes. Starting to get sexually aroused, and he's wondering why. And then he looks, there's Kamadev, and with the fire coming out of his forehead, he shoots a beam out, and Kamadev is, he's turned to ashes, he goes up instantly. So, Shiva burns him to ashes. So, what are they going to do? There is a goddess, daughter of the Himavat, who's the patriarch of the Himalayas, and her name is Parvati. And Parvati is attracted to Shiva. So how will we get Shiva to participate in culture and civilization and become domesticated is the question, because they need his potency. So Parvati does not approach him in some demanding way. She does the same as Shiva. She meditates. And through the power of her meditation, she meditates on Shiva. And also through, she becomes attached to him and in a loving and devotional manner. And that's when she approaches Shiva, Shiva is interested in her. And that's how they produce Kartikeya. And Kartikeya, who's the god of war, becomes their son. And he's the one who helps the gods overcome the Asuras. So Kartikeya is also called what?
Mars.
No. Murugan in the south. What else?
Skanda.
Skanda. Yeah. So Parvati uses meditation, tapas, or mental fire. That's what Shiva uses. Tapas in meditation generates fire. Not physical fire, but mental fire. And that gives powers or the ability to create whatever it is you want to create in the material world. So they have Kartikeya, and then Parvati says, so let's have another child. And Shiva says, what for? You know, I'm not interested. I want to go back to my meditation. So Parvati, while Shiva's away, creates her own child, Ganesh. And Ganesh, he's male. He's there, and Parvati says, I'm going to go in now. I'm going to take my bath. And I want you to stand outside and make sure no one comes in. And he says, okay, you can do that. So now Shiva, who's been away in meditation for some time, comes in, and he wants to go and see his wife, Parvati. And there's this child there that he's never met, that he knows nothing about. Child, excuse me, wait a second. You can't go in there. What do you mean you can't go in there? No, you're not allowed in. Parvati doesn't want anybody in. So what does Shiva do? Lops off his head and replaces it with what? An elephant head. So why does he lop off his head? Again, it's an expression of the ego not surrendering to the aspect of the Godhead, which is Shiva. And yeah, he's doing his job, but then Ganesh, of course, then becomes very famous as the one who destroys obstacles and brings good fortune into the home. And this is a side note. So Parvati says to Shiva one day, we have two children and you have all your followers. And of course Shiva hangs out in crematoriums and various places and with various hobgoblins and other kinds of characters. And they need to eat, so I need to establish a kitchen. And she says, what do you need a kitchen for? Well, Shiva, of course, is beyond hunger. He doesn't need a kitchen. So, but she says, no, but they're hungry and they need a kitchen. He says, no, I'm not interested. So Parvati leaves him. And he goes all around with a begging bowl trying to beg some food for his children, for everybody else, without much luck. Ends up in where? Varanasi. And in Varanasi, there's Parvati with her kitchen that she's established. And she's cooking away to feed her children. So this is where Parvati then becomes famous as Annapurna, the one who always has food to offer to everybody. Okay. Next one, Sita. In the story of Sita and Ram, Sita was beauty incarnate, the goddess of fortune herself. Within her mind, Sita could vividly read everything in the innermost core of Ram's heart. That's what women can do. Does every woman do that? No. But she's supposed to. She has the potential to do that. The other thing women do is they have this very powerful intuition, and they can sense things. We call it, I don't know if they still call it, we call it woman's intuition. I have met many very successful men, well, some of them successful, let's put it that way, clients of mine, who never listen to their wives, do not listen to their wives' intuition when the husband has a problem or a circumstance that he has to deal with and he's not sure exactly which way to go. So I'll say to the man, my client, for example, sometimes they're sitting together, I'll say, well, what did she say about it? Your wife. My wife. She doesn't know anything about business. She doesn't know anything about my business. Why would I ask her? And then she says, I told him not to do it. I told him. I had a bad feeling. See? There you go. You did it. And what happened? Well, I lost a lot of money. Because you didn't listen to her. You didn't even ask her. So, the power of intuition, well, men have it too, is there, and it needs to be developed, and it needs to be relied on. Sometimes people say to me, well, I followed my intuition, but it was wrong. No. You didn't follow your intuition, and it was wrong. Well, it didn't happen like I thought. No, because your desire got in the way of your intuition. When you have a very powerful desire for something to go a certain way, and you're trying to tap into your intuition, good luck, because your desire will override it, because, oh, but I really want that. Yeah, well, you're not listening. Anyway, back to Sita. So Sita could read everything in the innermost core of Ram's heart. Wishing to please her husband and acting as the emblem of womanly gentleness and chastity, Sita was easily able to bring the heart of Lord Ram under her control. That's a quote from Shastra. How to control a man, ladies. Nowadays, we have this intermixture of the sexes. And if you say anything that is in the least sexist, as the term they've come to use, suggesting that there's any difference whatsoever between male and female, well, you can get a blowback that like you've never seen before, particularly if you're a well-known person, you'll get it. There's all kinds of differences between male and female, and I don't care, you can't homogenize them, no matter how hard you try, you know. And men don't have babies, for example. So if you want to influence a man, you do not act like a man. Many of my clients, I have very, very successful women clients, very powerful women, many of them wealthy, many of them highly successful, some of them very famous. And I always tell them, don't lose your feminine approach. Stay in your feminine energy. Especially the executives that are working in business. In business, you know, as they often say, the business is a man's game. Well, there's many, many female, capable females in business. We know that. But if women approach it like men do, it doesn't work. It doesn't work in what sense? I've seen many of them acting like men for 20 years, literally 20 years, 30 years, and now there's various kinds of female diseases that they get. I've seen this countless times. It's not that they can't do business or be in the corporate world. You can't. But you still have to express yourself as a woman and remember that that's what you are and that there is a difference. So when it comes to relationships, marriage, you don't influence your husband by hitting him over the head with a stick. You might argue, yeah, but that works. And then I'll have to say, oh, well, okay then. No, you don't do it like that. You do it through being a woman and being in the feminine energy. That's what men like. They like women, in case you hadn't noticed. And being respectful. So, Sitan Ram, divine energy or the presence of God exists with Sitan Ram in love that is not opposed to Dharma. A deep abiding love goes beyond the physical as well as the current individuality in life and connects with the soul of the beloved. You want a fully manifested and all-encompassing relationship with your spouse, with your partner, then you have to go beyond gender recognition. Beyond that is individuality level, seeing the person. That's also important. And then beyond that is soul. There has to be a spiritual connection. There has to be a level of spirituality or spiritual nature to the relationship. What does that mean? A spiritual connection. This soul is on a journey. In this lifetime, they have a male body, they have a female body, whatever they have. And we're different races, we're different nationalities, we can see it. So connecting to the soul means, what is this soul trying to achieve in this lifetime? What is this soul's purpose? What is their goal? How are they unfolding themselves? What are they here to learn? And if you say, I'm not interested in any of that, then you're not interested in the spiritual aspect of the relationship. If you're not interested in individuality, who they are, and they want to fulfill themselves as a person, as a human, then you only must be interested in the fact that it's a male or a female with certain body parts, which is the fundamental level of attraction. So Sitan Ram, of course, it's God and Goddess, but it was operating at all levels. Can it operate at all levels for you as well? Yes. Yes, it can. What if I don't have that? Well, then work on developing it. That's a complete relationship. Ravan comes into the picture in the Ramayana. And Ravan hears about Sita and he wants it. So this then indicates our original sin, which is enviousness of God and God's position. Ravan wants what Ram has, Ram's God. There's a lower levels of that, of course, down here where we are, envious of somebody else's mate or somebody else's partner or someone else's wife or husband. That's a lower level. But that's there. So the juxtaposition here is between Ram and Ravan. Ravan is a demon that's caused a lot of problems, and he's taken over. Well, he threw his brother Kuvera out of his kingdom, and he took it over. And he was, even the gods were afraid of him, the demigods. So Ram represents Dharma, Ravan represents Adharma. Ram is intellect, Ravan operates on instinct. Ram is soul, Ravan is ego. Look at what you do. Your actions. What actions? All of them. Your actions, your statements, your thoughts. Any of them. And find the motivation behind it. Who's speaking? Is it soul? Is it the enlightened consciousness within you? Or is it ego? Soul, self, Atma is inclusive. Is it just about me? No. It may be something that I want to do. That's fine. Because I'm inside the body. Is it going to cause any harm to others? In which case, would I do it? Or, conversely, is it going to offer any benefit to others? Even better. As opposed to ego. I want to do because I want to do it. I don't really care if it hurts somebody else or if someone else doesn't get an opportunity because I beat them to it. That's ego. So we want to, over time, dissolve ego. Is it easy to do? No, it isn't. It's difficult to do, as you know, when you've tried to do. Ram attracts through love. Ravan uses power. What's more powerful? Love or power? Love, ultimately. Ram is detached. Ravan is attached. Ram is the best among men. Ravan's the worst among demons. Okay. Let's move on to Lakshmi. Lakshmi is the goddess of fortune. They churn the ocean of milk. Why do they churn the ocean of milk? Demons and the gods. Big churning rod. Why did they do it? To produce the Amrit. The nectar of immortality. I thought Chanel had that nectar. Wasn't it Chanel? Which one of those makeup companies has the nectar of immortality? They talk like they do, don't they? I will keep you young for years. Really? Yes. 1495. So, Lakshmi appeared out of the ocean of milk when they were churning it, gods and the demons. Lakshmi, the most beautiful woman imaginable. Imaginable. Down here, up, beyond, up there, doesn't matter. And the demigods who were there, who were churning on one side, the demons were, or the asuras, were churning on the other. Demigods said, they lined up when they saw Lakshmi. Oh my God, I want her. And they queued up in a nice line. And Lakshmi walked down the line, looking at each and every one of them. She was of marriageable age. She was looking for a husband. Even better. And? Oh, you know this word, svayamvara, that they always use in the Puranas and Mahabharata. Svayamvara is when they have a contest, or they invite a bunch of princes to come, and the princess is going to have her svayamvara and make her choice. Sometimes they have a contest of skill or something like that. But the Sanskrit word svayamvara, two words, is vara. Vara, as words go in Sanskrit, has 53 meanings. 53. So anyway, one of the meanings is choice. Svayamvara is self-choice, where the woman chooses who she wants. And I know all you ladies would prefer that, I think. So anyway, there's Lakshmi walking down the line of gods. And the first one had undergone great austerity and penance, but he had not yet conquered his anger. Could she see all this? Yes, instantly. The next one was very beautiful, but he was a slave to sensuality and sexuality. So she said, no, not him. It's quietly, of course. The next one radiated knowledge, which he found to be very attractive, but he still had a lot of material desires. So that didn't capture her. Next, the next one possessed a vast knowledge of religion, ethics, and morality, but he had not yet learned to be compassionate and kind to all beings. And it goes on. So, in her mind, she said, no, 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 no. And at the end, standing over there, the one who made all of this happen and facilitated it, was Vishnu himself. Was Vishnu in the queue? No, he wasn't. And she took one look at Vishnu and said, yeah, that's the one. Why? Because Vishnu was, or is, Atmarama, self-satisfied. He has no needs. And he's also Bhagavan. He has all of the opulences of the Godhead. And he wasn't yearning for her, which is also, people find that very attractive. We call it playing hard to get. So that's what happened. Lakshmi married Vishnu. Now, when they talk about Lakshmi, which is wealth and good fortune and all the things that come with it, it's not just money. They also talk about A Lakshmi, and they say A Lakshmi is who? Lakshmi's sister. And what does A Lakshmi mean? She represents poverty, strife, decay, and destruction. How are we to take this? Wealth flows like a river. And rivers flow. It comes down, passes you by, and it keeps going. That's wealth. What does that mean? You should grab it and hoard as much of it as you can? No. You attract wealth to yourself. You attract the goddess to yourself to help you. That's what we're talking about. And the wealth is used for your needs, and it's put back into the system. It keeps flowing. It goes to other people in exchange for goods, services, and it continues to flow. Am I telling you you shouldn't save something for a rainy day? No, I'm not telling you that. But hoarding and being greedy, there are wealthy people, I know some of them, you do too, who no matter how much money they have, they want more. I know people who are multi-millionaires. That's not enough. They always want more. And nowadays we have more and more billionaires. How do we have billionaires and we have so many people starving? How is that exactly? And the billionaire is sitting on his money and just trying to make more money. Yet this money is required in so many ways for so many people. Why is that? I mean, no one could, you don't need a billion to live on, for example. So Alakshmi, or the opposite of Lakshmi, is when people begin to hoard, when they become greedy, when they argue over money. There's also an attitude. If you have an attitude of lack, there's never enough. I don't have enough. I don't know why that person has this and this and that. I don't have. And you don't understand why it's happening like that, and you become resentful or you become angry. In other words, you develop a negative state of mind. That's what we're talking about. Is that negative state of mind, that contractive state of mind, it's not expansive, is it? Is a contractive mental state or emotional state, is that going to be able to attract wealth to you? Tell me. Is Lakshmi going to want to come and visit your house? What to speak of, set up shop at your house? And allow you to expand yourself and fulfill your desires and your needs and continue to grow and develop and evolve as a person? Both materially and spiritually, is that going to happen when you have that mentality? No, my friends, it's not. And you can get angry at the world, you can get angry at the government, you can get angry at, make your list. And some of these people may directly or indirectly be at fault in your situation. That may also be true. But is that attitude going to turn things around for you, do you think? No, it isn't at all. You have to change your attitude. Fundamentally, you have to change your attitude. You have to embrace. You have to be grateful. And you have to expand yourself out into the world in a positive sense. Very, very important. So this, anytime where there's fighting over money or disagreement, or that means the goddess of fortune is not in your home. When there's a lot of argument and strife and threatening in your home, there's no divine feminine living there, my friends. She's not there. She probably didn't arrive. Or if she was there, she's gone. And that behavior will not get her back. This is important. It's practical. Okay, finally. Finally, Radha Krishna. Chintamani prakrasad masu kapo viksha lakshavriteshu surabir abhipalayantam. Lakshmi sahasra shatasambrama sevyamanam govindam adipurusham tamaham bhajami. Well, there's God, Krishna, Lakshmi Sahasra Shata. Hundreds of thousands of goddesses of fortune accompany God. That's what this says from the Brahma Samhita. Hundreds of thousands. How does he get so many? He attracts them. How many do you need? Hundreds of thousands? If you're a woman, you need to become the goddess of fortune. You need to embody it. If you're a man, you need to attract it. And when a woman and a man come together in relationship and it expands and your life becomes better and more fulfilled and happier and there's more wealth, that's it. If you come together in relationship and everything begins to shrink and there are losses and you're unhappy and you're miserable, that's not good. That's not the goddess of fortune. Okay? So, Radha and Krishna, well, they say that Lord Ram is the keeper of laws and Krishna is the breaker of laws. Krishna likes to behave outside of the confines of the laws. He's a bit of a rascal. He is. Radha was absolutely devoted to Krishna. And they would meet secretly in the forest. Why in the forest? Because that's beyond the pale, right? It's beyond the civilization where all the laws and the proper behavior is. They meet in the forest. When? In the day? Mostly at night. So the concept here was that Radha and the gopis are these souls who have prayed to be with God for many, many lifetimes. They did austerities, they did tapas. And nothing's more important than their relationship with God. Now, I'm not saying this in terms of, you know, your wife neglecting you and neglecting the husband, neglecting the wife. No, I'm not. This is the higher level of when the most important thing that we devote ourselves to is our relationship to God. That's what Radha and Krishna is about. That is a goddess of fortune or divine feminine as well. But that is the eternal relationship, the eternal connection. And ultimately, that's where we're headed. And that's why we practice bhakti, yoga of love and devotion. Okay. So, I hope this has given you some insights into the divine feminine. Thank you for your kind attention. Are there any questions or comments? Ram.
You said that that Brahma doesn't have any temples. Would you say that a Christian church is like a temple for Brahma? In terms of what they want and how they're going about getting it?
Well, I suppose from that point of view, I mean, you can pray to God for whatever you like, naturally. And that if you have material desires and you want certain things to happen materially, which I don't know who doesn't, generally speaking. I suppose. But you see, when they say a Brahma temple, there must be an effigy of Brahma in the temple. There must be some representation of the deity, either a picture or a, you know, a form or something. There's actually a Brahma temple in Pushkar. I had to go. I mean, it's the only one. Anyone else? Mayesh?
White people worship Kali. I mean, she's so scary.
Well, yeah, but people who worship Kali, that's more tamas. It's more motive ignorance. And they offer what? What do they offer to Kali?
Goats.
Sorry?
Animals.
Animals, Meat, blood, alcohol, wine. That's what you offer. Who was it that used to chop off pieces of his body and throw him in the fire? Who was that? Prakasara. Yeah. Swaha. You know, I mean, you have to understand that's a lower mode. You know, and then you're getting into the tantric side of things. You know, is there such a thing as ghosts and hobgoblins and rakshasas? And yeah, they exist. I've dealt with people from India, from Central America, from Mexico, from all over China that use black magic. Clients of mine. Or this one puts a curse on the family or puts a curse on us. Believe me, I've heard the stories. Helped some of them. Couldn't help them all, let me tell you. That black magic business, you know, what, Santeria, voodoo, it works. Do I recommend it? No. I don't. Because, you know, you're going to get reaction for that. Huh? You don't want that reaction.
But not all tantra is black magic.
No. It's not. Not all tantra is black magic. Depends what the goal is. Depends what the goal is.
The goddess Kamaskaya.
Kamaskaya?
Kamaskaya.
Mm-mm. Well, I'm familiar with Kama. Yeah.
She's based mainly in Assam.
In Assam, mm-hmm. Up in the north of India. Yeah.
She has certain Kali aspects.
Mm-hmm.
But she's revered by not by people. She does have a dark side, but she has a wonderfully bright side as well, which helps people to realize their true nature, but also to express themselves both in a familial way,
mm-hmm.
But also a sexual way.
Mm-hmm. But is the sexuality one of the main focuses?
The fecundity is the
reproduction,
but not the actual sexual act itself.
Yeah. See, then you have to look at levels of consciousness. So, for example, if people, for some people, sexuality is really important, whether they're tantrics or not. I just happen to know a lot of tantrics for whom sexuality was, you know, kind of. I mean, it's a means to the end of raising their consciousness. But that's second chakra, sexuality. It's second chakra. Now, if you can move it up out of second chakra and up through the chakra system until you achieve realization, then fine. But a lot of them get stuck in second chakra, and that's what they do. So... depends. Okay.
Could you state, like, contextualize Mahamaya and Yogamaya in the context of Vaishnava sadhana? Now, what is the purpose of those two forces?
Well, Mahamaya is the external nature, the material nature. And Yoga Maya is the spiritual nature, the internal potency. So essentially what you're trying to do is overcome the external energy, the material nature, and enter into the internal energy. No, you don't disrespect anything or anybody. Disrespect is never part of any equation. Go disrespect a person on the street that you don't even know and see what happens. No, never disrespect. Always respect everyone and all the gods in all religions. Whether you're an adherent of a particular religion doesn't matter. You still offer respect to the people who practice that religion. Absolutely essential. Otherwise, you're acting out of what? Ego, superiority, sanctimony. I'm better than you, holier than thou. Which means what? Which means you're not very advanced at all, spiritually. That's what it would mean. Okay. Thank you. Hare Krishna.